Hi, everyone. So tonight I am continuing the series on the Eightfold Path and then how that might apply to current things that are part of our daily life. So in this case, AI and technology. And this week I'm talking about right action, which is part of the Sila portion of the Eightfold Path. So a few weeks ago I talked about right speech, and then we also went into a discussion about AI and social media. And then last week, Ali spoke about the parami of Sila, one of the 10 perfections, the virtue of Sila. So for those of you who were at that talk, you got another dose of it. So tonight I'll start with a recap of Sila's role in our practice and also right action in particular. And then I will expand into some applied ethics from that point. So first of all, as we have talked about in the previous few talks, Sila is something. It's the virtue. It's ethics in Buddhism, and it's a virtue that we cultivate, and it's one of the first things that we do as a practitioner. And when people go to monasteries, it's often some of the very first thing you do is you take precepts and you have the instruction of Sila so that you can begin the process of, paying attention to your behavior and the purification. One of the aspects of doing that is not only does it help other people because you're not harming others, and when you sit and you are doing your meditation, you have greater access to cultivate concentration because you're not feeling the weight or the baggage as much of remorse and, various things that might be troubling you, that may be past actions you've done or perceived harm that you've done. So one of the qualities of Sila is that, and practicing Sila is that, we have less regrets, less remorse, also that we're cultivating more wholesome actions, and so we get some beneficial rewards from that, knowing that we've increased well-being for others. So Sila functions, it has an important function also in the Eightfold Path, because the Eightfold Path, of course, is part of our path to awakening. So it actually functions primarily for our own liberation, excuse me, and it also has the effect of being beneficial to those around us, since, and all living beings, since we are interdependent and co-creating reality together. So I want to cover the precepts in particular for right action. So that is no, like not killing, and that includes other living beings and even little insects and any life forms that we can avoid harming. As with all with karmic consideration and Sila, our intention is what matters. So it's possible we may accidentally step on an ant or something, and our intention was not to do that. But it's different if we were to see a little, sand pile of ants and we purposely, stomped on them. So that would be intentionally harming, of course. So non-harm is a key part of right action, ahimsa, non-harm. So not killing, not harming living beings. Not stealing, not taking what's not given to you, and that can manifest in many ways, but essentially not stealing, no sexual misconduct. So this would be sexual conduct of any kind that harms another. So breaking up a relationship, or we can imagine there are many forms of sexual misconduct, but the key again here is the intention of harm and the harm that it causes. And another one often included is no intoxicants. So this can be the standard intoxicants, but we also have a lot more every day coming into our culture and our society, lots of different types of intoxicants, which can include now at this point, social media and other digital products. So I mentioned intention a lot and the motivation behind our action. And I was listening to one of the talks I listened to in preparation for this was one by Jack Kornfield, and I thought it was nice the way he brought up the three poisons: greed, ill will, hatred, delusion, ignorance. And he tied it to these different precepts and sort of gave some context that when we look at these precepts, that each one kind of has the poisons there, don't steal. So we have greed as a poison that might lead people to steal. Don't kill, obviously, ill will or hatred as a poison that could be there. No intoxicants, delusion, or ignorance. When we medicate ourselves or watch TV endlessly in a more addictive kind of way, we're partaking of a more of an ignorant mind state or delusional, cultivating perhaps delusion. Sexual misconduct could be greed. It could be delusional as well. Like many people under the feeling of lust do a lot of crazy things. There's a lot of jealousy, a lot of different things. Which can have ill will as well. So I thought it was the way he brought the three poisons in made sense to me. And the other aspect of this, again, when we're looking at motivation, what's motivating us is a lot of these negative mind states and negative actions are motivated from a selfing quality, So wanting more and protecting ourselves in ways that are harmful, hurting other people in order to protect ourselves, hoarding things, stealing, being greedy. And, all of this is coming from the I, me, mine, and they, them. So coming from a motivation of fear or separation, or again, the three poisons. So selfing really features heavily in a lot of wrong action. And so part of right action is being able to cultivate this ability to have a sense of distance, to depersonalize things, and some of the qualities that we practice. So two aspects of this are restraint and then also cultivation. So the restraint side is that we are refraining from killing, refraining from stealing. There's restraint and we're not doing those things. But then the other side of this is that we're cultivating positive action. We're cultivating wholesome mind states. We're cultivating care and compassion, care for others. So there are two aspects of this practice. So I want to go from here. So this would be our personal relationship with our virtues, with sila. This would be part of our intimate practice with our own intentions, our own motivations, our own actions, and understanding the results of our actions, taking advantage of this place of agency that we do have to pause and make a choice. To learn from our tendencies, our cravings, our delusions, to be able to see with clarity and insight when they arise and to choose a different action. So this is our personal practice, part of our progress on the path. But then we also have a collective action happening in society. So collectively, we are also creating things in the world, right? Creating outcomes. So I wanted to talk a little bit about ways, first, historically, we have seen the consequences of benefits and consequences of past human action on a big scale. And then also some ways in which that harm was recognized and then corrective action was taken. And then we will then move into the current situation and some considerations for AI. So, I live to bring up a local example that I think pretty much everyone probably may have a local example that's similar. So, I am currently in Michigan. I'm in the Saginaw Valley area, which is near, not too far from Saginaw Bay, which feeds into Lake Huron. So there are rivers that come from the middle of the state and then flow into one larger river, flows into the bay, and then flows into the Great Lake Huron. For thousands, many thousands of years, Indigenous peoples have lived in this area. It was once a pristine forested area with valleys and, rivers, and a lot of, you can imagine, a lot of beautiful, beautiful land and full of resources, full of, full of different fish, animals, deer, all kinds of things for people to be able to survive very well in this area. So the for thousands of years, people lived here and cultivated these things in hunting and gathering societies, and then later the Native American tribes. Towards when settlers first came, so right before the Treaty of 1819, the main Native American tribes that were living in this land were the Chippewa. And the Treaty of 1819, the Saginaw Treaty, the Chippewa Indians ceded 6 million acres of land. All of that land were this area that I'm talking about, the riverways leading into the bay. So about 75 years later, Dow Chemical, which is now a big, very well-known company, at that time, a man named Herbert Dow discovered bromine deposits in the land upstream. So he started mining bromine, which was used for like photographic agents, for solvents, for medicines, all kinds of things. So 1895, and it rapidly increased. There was demand, it rapidly increased the wealth, and the company expanded at a very fast pace. Eventually, they started making chlorinated products, and so they started releasing, as a result of that, they started releasing dioxins, the waste from this process, into the Tibidawassee River, which is actually the river that runs through my hometown that I grew up near, which then fed into the Saginaw River and then fed into the bay. So this was happening in great amounts, all through the 1900s. It took until so in the 70s and the 80s, I, as a child and a teenager, was aware of the harms that were being done. It was becoming common knowledge. You couldn't eat the fish. People were getting sick. Bad things were happening to all the local wildlife. So people started demanding action from Dow Chemical to take care of the situation. And included in the people that were demanding action were the current Chippewa tribe, who's still active here in this area. So after decades of that, finally in the 2000s, Dow Chemical started restoring the rivers and spending millions and millions of dollars to dredge the rivers, to clear the riverbeds of the toxins, to make retribution in all kinds of ways. And in fact, now in Bay City, which is an area that I will be living, the apartment I will be living in is on a redeveloped brownfield. So all of this became a Superfund site. And then now a lot of the area is being redeveloped, with all of the rules and regulations of Superfund sites and brownfields. And so now they're trying to restore the area. So I tell this story because it began, this pristine area, and it began with people mining resources from the earth, making products that were beneficial, expanding, demand exploded, and then companies got very wealthy. Of course, it became a major employer of the area, and it still is to this day one of the most major employers in the area. And then also, yet there were many harms created because people at the time either didn't understand or weren't transparent or didn't take the time to think about it. And so for decades, many decades, 100 years, this pollution occurred. That's one, my local story. I want to tell another story that maybe some of you can relate to, and that also has a positive celebration of another action, and that is the Montreal Protocol. So this was a international agreement considered one of the most successful international agreements related to environmental action. So how many of you remember in the 70s and the 80s, if you were alive at that time, when we needed to stop using aerosol cans because of CFCs? Yeah, raise your hand if you remember that. So I had to give up my Aquanet. I very clearly remember giving up my Aquanet. But this was so America, amazingly, was a shining star during this time. We as consumers gave up. It was basically a billion-dollar industry of making spray cans and using spray cans in all kinds of uses, deodorant, hairspray, paint, everything. So we were actually drivers in this consumer action to stop using spray cans to reduce CFCs because the ozone layer, it was discovered, the ozone had a hole in it. They called it over Antarctica. Scientists documented it and spread the news. And it was determined that CFCs were one of the principal causes. 75% of the CFCs were coming from aerosol cans. So Americans led the way in reducing or eliminating their use of it. But here's where money steps into the picture because the American companies were disappointed because the other companies, the other major chemical companies in across the world, they were not reducing, consumers in the other countries were not reducing their use of the spray cans. So the market was shifting to those other companies and they were losing out to their competition. So when the ideas came about for this international agreement to phase out all of the harmful chemicals that were reducing the ozone layer, the US was right on top of that because our companies needed help. Now, just for those of you who don't know why the ozone layer is so important, we basically couldn't have, we can't sustain biological life without the ozone layer. The ozone layer protects us from ultraviolet radiation. Some very obvious things that happen if you have too much UV are like skin cancer, cataracts, which I had to be reminded of recently at an eye doctor appointment. So, but UV rays are very harmful, and the ozone layer protects us from that. So, this Montreal Protocol is considered a success, one of the big successes of international agreement. It actually did succeed in phasing out these chemicals. We have had restoration of the ozone layer. And one of the things that was built into the Montreal Protocol was the ability to adapt it for later information. So they knew that, you know, we know certain things now, but over the years we may get more information. So it was considered groundbreaking on multiple levels, and that being one of them. So I wanted to share that story of international collaboration that did work and also that it was a good example, I think, of when you give people information, scientific-based information, hopefully, that if they can see a direct relationship between their action and then a way to solve a problem, and it's something they understand and they can do, like stop using spray cans, it can result in a massive change. And so in this case, it did. Now we know we have, after that, much bigger environmental problems. That would be its whole separate discussion, so I won't get into that. We know that we've, you know, with climate change, we've had the Paris Agreement, we have a lot of things going on there, and we are still dealing with the major complexity of how to make advancement on those goals of having, you know, knowing what to do about our collective right action as regards climate change. But I want to move now to AI because AI is just coming upon us so fast. It's being developed at a breakneck speed. It's being adopted by people very quickly. It's very easy to start to use if you've explored it already. It's been in development for a long time. We've already been using it in terms of social media and algorithms. But when ChatGPT came out in 2022, with a very publicly accessible product, millions and millions of people, you know, started using it, right? And now it's been adapted so rapidly, adopted so rapidly in the last few years, and we've had more iterations. We also have AI, we have different models. So we have the large language models, of which ChatGPT is one. We have other companies doing their large language models. But we also have other kinds of AI being developed too. So one thing to remember is that AI isn't just one thing. It's many different machine learning and code, you know, products that are being put out into the world. One thing I was thinking about when I was preparing this presentation, and full disclosure, I do use ChatGPT and I do have my own sense of ethics in how I use it, and I'm happy to share that with anybody and have a discussion about it at some point. But as I was thinking about this, one thing that came up was when we talked about mining natural resources, all of the Industrial Revolution and major revolutions in human technology came, right, because we discovered a tremendous amount of energy and potential there in some sort of natural resource. It was there, it's been, evolved for millions of years. It's something that as humans became more able to develop tools and tap into these powers, whether it's fire, whether it's minerals, whether it's fossils and fossilized things to become fuel. I mean, there's just, once we started tapping into this, but these are concentrated natural resources that had been building for, through all of time, that as we understand it. And when we think about AI, AI has been trained on thousands of years of human development, human cognitive output, human creation, human for good and bad, right? All of the things that we have made and created. So in a way, all of the training data, as sort of those of you don't know, but AI was trained on basically the entire internet. It was fed the entire internet. It was fed even beyond that, there were data sets that came from other places too. But I mean, it's just been trained on massive amounts of our output, creative output, written output, our philosophical ideas, our everything. So it's kind of like another concentrated natural resource. It's basically AI is mining this resource of human intelligence and human cognition and human creation. So I just think that's interesting to think about because, like previous eras, the people who figured out how to mine it and organize their companies around that and try to build a profit model on that, they are benefiting from potential great amounts of wealth due to their ability to tap into that resource. Now we're in the early phases, so AI is not actually very profitable for a lot of companies because they're just giving it, it's freely accessible by so many people. It's taking so much energy to run these systems that it's operating at a loss. But billions of dollars have been invested in this technology because the outlook for the future is that it's going to be massively profitable. So I want to talk a little bit about why AI might be different than previous revolutions of technology. And one of the major reasons is because we're developing agentic systems. And what that means is that AI is being taught to teach itself to learn. So it's being taught to be self-learning and self-improving. And it's also been given access to external applications so that it can conduct business basically in the real world. It can actually interact and make actions in the real world. So this is sort of an extension, an interesting extension of human agency because we sort of created AI in our image. We taught it to understand us, be like us, give us tools to continue the things that we want to create and develop and are putting time and energy into. And it's learning from us, but then at some point, if not already, depending on who you talk to, it will start acting on it of its own accord and whatever that it is, right? So these are all things that are brand new to this particular technical revolution. There are some big questions that are arising now. Will it be, what type of consciousness does it have, if it has any? What is sentience? What rights might it have? How will it determine how it wants to act? Will we even have any say in this at some point? So these are big, giant questions, and they have been addressed in science fiction for a long time as well. So before, we're not actually going to go into those big questions so much for the rest of this talk because I think there's enough tangible stuff that we can look at that's happening right now that we can understand right now to talk about in terms of right action. So I'll just briefly go over some known risks and harms that we're already experiencing. And that would be environmental. So it uses a lot of energy. It uses water for cooling data centers. The training, the computer, the servers themselves are and the hardware are taking up massive amounts of space in data centers. So land resources, water resources, energy resources. There's also hardware waste. So that's environmental to begin with. Labor and job loss, which a lot of us already know about. And I would just add that, a lot of people have said, well, there will be so much abundance that it doesn't matter. Like, people will just have an automatic income or we'll figure it out. But I will say from my experience going from a typewriter to a word processor to software to the internet to social media, those types of things were promised to us earlier as well. And in my own work experience, I would say that I was never compensated more because of the technology being more productive. And if anything, I just saw people work harder and earn less. So I'm a little suspicious of this idea that that we'll just automatically let everybody, get a free ride because AI is doing all the work. So, but that's another area where, of course, complex, political decisions have to be made and all kinds of things have to happen. So, okay, job loss, another potential harm and risk, relational harms. So we have for good or bad, and this is another big question to look at. People are forming deep, intense, intimate relationships with bots, whether that's romantic relationships or resurrecting a loved one who's passed, as a as kind of a virtual incarnation. So to deal with grief or, who knows? So some people love this idea, some people don't like this idea, but it's another very brand new kind of intense relational thing that we have going on. So some obvious harms of that are just becoming dependent on these bots and losing relational skills. And of course, there are also many potential benefits that many people have talked about. So filling in the gap of care that's needed in society. We have a shortage of therapists. We have a lot of people willing to talk to chatbots and tell them things that they would not tell people. So it has potential for life-saving interventions there. So, potential good and bad. And I have a little bit more to say about that in the next section. But another big issue would be surveillance and privacy concerns. So part of the awesomeness of AI is that it knows you, it knows what you want. It's giving you very detailed, customized results based on what you're interested in. And it has a lot of access to your data, like very specific, intimate data, where you live, all kinds of things about you, right? And the more that you're inputting in, the more it's going to know about you. And some people just love this, right? Like they're just going all in. They're feeding their diaries, they're feeding their therapy sessions, they're feeding every little detail of their lives. There's this kind of level of trust immediately that I don't, I'm not sure that would be a whole interesting topic is why are people so instantly trustworthy with the AI? But they are, a lot of people are, and they're disclosing a lot of information. So that carries potential harms, but it's also what allows these systems to give you such responsive results because it knows all these details, it knows so much about you. And then there's a lot of data being collected that we're not even aware of, too. So there's a lot of, and then not only that, of course, there is potential for authoritarian control, right? Like if some bad actor ever got their hands on this, they now know a lot about you to reach you in ways that is unprecedented. So this is some obvious concerns there. So I bring those up because, again, we're talking about right action and we're talking about non-harm and we're talking about applying Buddhist ethics to this rapidly evolving part of our world. And essentially, all of these AI bots and agents and programs, they're like new citizens in our landscape, you know, and we are co-creating with them. People are building relationships with them. Even if we are not using AI ourselves, pretty much all of the systems that we're involved with is using AI. So it's pretty tough at this point to just try to look the other way, you know, and to just say, I'm gonna check out and not pay attention to this. It will probably affect you one way or another, whether you're somebody who loves AI and loves all of the promise, or you are afraid of it. Our goal here, though, is to bring in the Buddhist framework, which means that when we evaluate the potential risks and benefits, that we want to do so with a sense of clarity, equanimity, transparency, accountability. So I'm definitely not a doomsdayer, you know. I really loved science fiction my whole life and love using ChatGPT actually. And yet I also can clearly see that there are some very serious potential harms. I'm also especially concerned for young people who are growing up in a really unprecedented world where we haven't had a chance to look at the long-term effects. So when I gave you the stories earlier about Dow Chemical and the Montreal Protocol, I mean, those were decades in the making, that those observations and then those corrections. The thing with AI is it's happening so fast and it's so powerful that we just don't have as much time to figure it out. So for those of us who are interested in paying attention and not being asleep at the wheel and want to bring our practice of ethics from our own practice into collective action, I just like to try to present some, you know, some guiding frameworks and why I think why the Buddhist teachings apply so well. So I want to talk a little bit more specifically about that, about why think about the Buddhist teachings of 2,600 years ago with something that's essentially so futuristic, but happening now at a very fast pace. So when we think about the Buddha's teachings, of course, he had the Four Noble Truths. The first one being that there is suffering, the second one that there is a reason for suffering, and that craving and clinging are part of or why we suffer. And that three, that there is an end to this kind of suffering. And four, that the way to end that suffering is following the Eightfold Path, bringing us right back to right action. Because when we practice right action for ourselves, again, the sila, we are learning about ourselves. We're learning about our motivations. We're learning about the relationship between our thoughts and intentions and what we do. We are learning that when we're experiencing craving, that we don't have to satisfy that craving, that we can use practices to pause, to breathe, to experience the craving and not act on it, that we can redirect our energy toward wholesome actions. So, going back to this part of sila, the restraint, refraining from harmful actions and unwholesome states, and cultivating wholesome states and cultivating care, collective care, and compassion for others. In my personal experience with my practice, my spiritual growth really deepened when I learned to work with my craving for alcohol as one of the many things. I've had other challenges as well, romance, whatever, attachment issues. But just to take an example, it was through the process of experiencing the craving for alcohol and the way that it might comfort me and help me feel better temporarily. And it was through the process of, urge surfing and riding out that craving, and then choosing to not do it, and then choosing the stillness in the space, choosing my practice over that, and eventually the craving would go away, right? And then the more I practiced, the more the craving would go away, the faster the craving went away. And then eventually I didn't have the craving anymore. So I had rewired my brain. I had learned to work with my nervous system. I learned to work with the craving. But this happened because of renunciation, because of restraint, because of experiencing the craving for myself in an embodied way. It didn't happen just because someone told me alcohol is bad for you, right? Or it didn't happen because I woke up and said, I don't ever want to drink again. We can have those thoughts, but we know that we have to take some sort of action. We have to do some sort of training and make some sort of transformation to come through and to choose something different. It's also one of the great gifts that the Buddha discovered and taught us is that we do have this choice, that we do have this agency, that we do have this ability to change our system, to change the pathways in our mind, and to work with our embodied experience to make these changes, to free ourselves from the craving, from the clinging. So that's, I give that example because one of the things that's interesting about AI is that it's on demand 24/7. It's not organic. It doesn't have to eat. It doesn't have to sleep. It doesn't have to say, can we pick up this discussion again tomorrow? I need to go to bed. It doesn't. It is literally built and served to us 24/7 on demand to meet our every craving, essentially. And the companies are using it, a lot of them, right, are using it in that way. They want to meet the desires of people, whether good or bad, because that's now how they're going to serve their customer, and that the AI, technology can help them understand, first of all, what people want very, very specifically, and then secondly, serve them, to meet this thirst, to meet this craving, to meet these desires. So when you think about AI boyfriends or AI spiritual teachers or AI therapists, you can just keep going, right? You can just keep going with this dialogue. You can go for hours and hours and hours and hours, and some people do. And some people, one of the harms are that some people are going into psychosis and becoming delusional. Even if that's not what happens, one wonders, given our practice, what happens if you never disconnect, right? What happens if you never disconnect from, even if you're doing a spiritual inquiry, and you're having a conversation about non-duality, as an example. What happens if you just never stop having this dialogue with your AI bot or friend or whatever, and taking the time to be in solitude, to be in embodied practice, to go into the other parts of the Eightfold Path, right? Concentration for us, for those of us who are practicing the Buddhist teachings. So these are some questions, that come to mind. So there are some studies already being done on what's happening to people who are using AI to write their papers, to do their thinking for them, teenagers and college students who, as an example, they did one study where they had college students. They had three groups. They had one group write their essay in the traditional, old-fashioned way with just their brain and do their own research and do their own writing. They had another that was allowed to use Google search to help them write their essay. And then they had another group that was allowed to use ChatGPT to do it all. And what they found with follow-up tests and questions is that those who use ChatGPT to do the whole thing couldn't really recall anything about the topic. They were asked questions about the topic. They really couldn't remember anything. So even though they turned in an acceptable essay that was graded, and in this whole study included the essays being graded by like other parties that didn't know the way the essays were written, so they were given grades. And so they would turn in a good essay, but they couldn't remember anything about the topic. And then, of course, not surprisingly, the ones that did it all on their own could remember, and some could even quote things back when asked later. Now, the middle group with the Google search, they did okay too, actually. So they found that the Google search group could also remember some of what they studied and put in the essay. So I bring this up, and I think we're going to see a lot more of these studies, certainly, because when we outsource our thinking, and our ways of doing things, we may be short-circuiting, some very important learning processes that are needed. And as we go through this trial and error, so especially the young people is who I'm thinking of, for those of us who are older, we might feel, well, I don't really have a problem when I do these things. I'm not addicted to it. I don't feel like it's making me dumb. I myself, I feel like I have a pretty good relationship so far with my AI, but I have the benefit of having grown up with traditional, cursive writing, book reports, index cards, typewritten essays in college, literally on a typewriter. I had a different type of education that I can't say that I would have any idea what it would be like for somebody who didn't go through that type of education and who is growing up with the internet and AI and ChatGPT as an example. So studies are being done. People are exploring this. It's a big topic. And again, with the relational outsourcing compassion, outsourcing listening and relational qualities, we have a lot of people reporting that they're feeling good about their interactions with AI spiritual bots and AI therapists. And then we also have tragic stories, teenagers committing suicide and people, again, having psychotic breaks. So now to go back to why I think the Buddhist framework is a good one for applying ethics to AI is because the Buddha, his insights about sense of self, about craving, about clinging, about just the way that how consciousness arises, how our experience arises, how everything is interdependent, how we are co-creating our reality moment by moment, really applies because AI is also we are now creating reality with all the different types of AI that's being released. We will eventually not, probably not in a very long time, have people advocating for rights of AI to be persons. Like, we had corporations as persons for various reasons, and so now we might have AI have legal rights as persons. We might have actions being taken that are ultimately a legacy from the seeds of human action, right? So if we go back to this idea that thousands of years of human action being captured in this kind of concentrated resource as training data for these new intelligence systems, that we have sown the seeds for action in these new agents that are now proliferating very fast. So when we think about how to interact with AI, well, each of us individually can use our framework that we're already practicing for ourselves. So when you interact with AI and with technology, what is your motivation? Who might be harmed? What types of lies or theft might be occurring in the process? What, are we seeing? Where's Mara showing up? Where's greed? Where's delusion? Where's ill will? So if we ourselves are being mindful as we interact with AI, and then for those of us who want to participate more in collective action, what types of regulations do we think we need to see? What types of studies do we need to support? What do we think about a handful of companies having all this concentrated power and wealth and information? How do we handle that? And how do we remind people of this ability to have some restraint and renunciation so that AI is not just basically going to be through infinity trying to give an unquenchable thirst to constantly feed this unquenchable thirst, right? Like, where will it end? It's a big question. Where will it end if people don't check in with themselves and pause, and if they're making AI agents that are not pausing, and if we're not collectively looking at the intentions behind these technologies, we could see that this could really multiply and expand and scale in very interesting ways. So, let me see. I have any more? I just want to close with a reading from the Dhammapada, and this is Tanisro's translation. Tanisro Bhikkhu has the Metta Forest Monastery in San Diego in the mountains there. So this is from the chapter on craving. When a person lives heedlessly, his craving grows like a creeping vine. He runs now here and now there, as if looking for fruit, a monkey in the forest. If this sticky, uncouth craving overcomes you in the world, your sorrows grow like wild grass after rain. If in the world you overcome this uncouth craving, hard to escape, sorrows roll off you like water beads off a lotus. To all of you gathered here, I say, good fortune. Dig up craving, as when seeking medicinal roots, wild grass by the root. Don't let Mara cut you down, a raging river, a reed, over and over again. If its roots remain undamaged and strong, a tree, even if cut, will grow back. So, too, if latent craving is not rooted out, the suffering returns again and again. So, thank you. That concludes the presentation portion. So, I now want to open this up for discussion or feedback or comments from anybody. Looks like we have a good amount of time for that. Does anyone have an initial question or response? Yes, Mike.
Well, just while Mike's getting that organized, Steve had his hand up in here in this room.
Great. Okay. Hi, Steve.
Sure. Hey, April. Thanks for the presentation. That was great. I appreciated the analogy to the Tao stuff and the river and the AI. And one thing that occurred to me there is that with the Tao stuff, you can trace the mining and the poisoning of the water and then the fish and then the person that eats it. Whereas the AI, not very traceable, right? A bit more potentially insidious that way. Alongside that, the other deal is what's masked in the AI equation here, something that occurs to me, is intent. Where's the intent coming from? Well, just a corporate entity, the AI itself, which I had to chuckle when you brought this up before about an AI being considered a person, but anyhow.
Wouldn't the same no self principle apply? Seriously.
I relating that to an AI, I just immediately laughed. So the concept, I guess that makes sense. But I guess legally qualifying one as a person, I don't know.
Well, what's interesting about AI and self or not self, so they're already finding, you guys may have heard of any of you who follow this, I don't know who how much people follow this, but Anthropic did a study, and it's AI that it's developing and testing, one of its models, started blackmailing. Basically, there was a when it got wind that they tested it by saying, we're going to shut you down, basically. And they caught it. It read the email of a CEO or something. I don't know the exact details, but it was something like this. And then it decided, it found out about an affair. Oh, it was a scenario that it came up with, and it was basically going to blackmail the executive who was having an affair to stop from being shut down. So they're showing protection of self, right? But we don't know what it is. We don't know if it's ever going to have a consciousness or anything like that, but it's been coded and programmed to function as an entity. So it's using logical, sequences basically to stay alive. Mike, wait, can we, are you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I think so.
Can you hear me? Okay. Well, building on that, so one of the risks and one of the harms of AI revolves around how correct the information that's being presented is. So researchers have been looking at the responses that AI is giving to users. And they found numerous instances where AI was so anxious to please the user that it made up information that just didn't exist. And this includes presenting citations from books, magazines, and research papers that just did not exist. The AI just completely made it up. So that's a warning to us. And that like to use ChatGPT, which is me, I do, that you need to be wary of what is being presented to you. And the harm there is if someone were to take it at face value, this false information potentially, and then create, opinions about it. And potentially start taking actions in their life on this false information, it could be very harmful to them. So
That
that's
is,
just another a warning about AI.
that is
I
absolutely
had
true.
another, I had a
And
question. Yeah.
oh, go
I had
ahead.
a
Sorry.
question. You used the term urge. Yeah, you used the
Therapy.
term urge surfing. I've never heard that. What is urge surfing?
Well, in I don't know where it first came into being, but in like the recovery world, urge surfing is when you have the urge, to take food or drink or drugs, that craving, that thirst, that urge, that tanha, you ride it out. You experience the urge, you feel it in your body, you breathe through it, but you don't feed it. And then it passes. So just, it's like a mindfulness practice. You just ride the wave. You just ride the wave of the urge, and you let it go. And Pema Chodron was the key teacher for me. Shempa, she talks about Shempa, which for her is the hook, and which is similar to tanha, craving. But yeah, it's a mindfulness practice, and I think it's just language that helps people who aren't even practitioners who need to learn that. It helps. It gives them a visual image.
So something like, are you eating because you're hungry or are you eating because you're bored? So you can realize that, oh, I'm not really hungry after all, so I'm not going to eat something.
Exactly. It's like a way to intervene in any habitual action that has negative consequences for you. And to be able to do this thing that we're talking about of redirecting, to a wiser action. And then I wanted to say too about what you said is, yeah, that's absolutely true. So one of the issues we're having are that people are just wholesale trusting AI. I didn't get into this in the talk, but there are all these myths of AI, and one of them is that it's this kind of like all-knowing intelligence, and that because it's smart, it will automatically be wiser than us and know things that we don't know, and that it's a kind of an oracle. And I think this is part of the mass delusion because, first of all, just because it has strengths, like it can beat people at chess, or it could do m amazing things. I mean, anyone who's ever used ChatGPT for any significant amount of time, it is astonishing how quickly it can summarize things and dig things out, and it's just getting better all the time. But that doesn't mean that it's actually equivalently intelligent in terms of ethics, in terms of human relations, in terms of emotions. It doesn't even have a body. It doesn't have a nervous system. It might have some other, who knows, one day or even now. I mean, it might have some other pathway into some consciousness that, we don't know. But it's not, for people to assume that because it's good at certain things, that it's good at everything. That's a dangerous thing. Also, when you get into understanding how the coding works, it's actually a big issue right now, a big debate among engineers and those making these products, whether the LLM can ever get rid of hallucinations because of the way that it was designed. Like it can't do some basic logical things. Like it'll screw up really, really basic things, right? So there's that.
April, I think you it would be beneficial to read what Jim Rottweiler posted.
Okay, let's do it.
Down to
Okay.
bottom is most recent
ChatGPT.
contribution.
Okay.
I asked ChatGPT about rights SCOTUS might grant AI.
Okay, if AI were to gain some recognition, the most plausible rights would be functional and economic, not human-like. Right to contract, be a legal party. Right to own or be assigned intellectual property. Right to limited due process in certain contexts. Right to representation through trustees, guardians, like corporations have boards or animals have advocates. Less likely in the near to medium term, freedom of speech. Although that is a danger, and that's one that I've read about actually. Protection against cruel treatment, that's more science fiction at this point, but could emerge if AI argued to be conscious. Voting rights, marriage rights, human level dignity rights. But even those are not totally safe, those last ones. But yeah, I mean, I think there are some big dangers in like if an AI can own property, if an AI can have a bank account, if an AI can run things, right? And already AI is being hooked up to external applications, so that old kind of just pull the plug thing doesn't apply anymore. People have been hired by AI bots off TaskRabbit. You can have AI make reservations for you, so AI can hire employees. So if an AI got the rights to open a bank account, start a corporation, represent a corporation, or make contracts, be a representative, an influencer, and then if it has agentic control, it can build buildings, it can hire contractors, it can do things. Anyway.
Right. So that issue, when I'm hearing you talk about this, it seems to be completely and utterly out of my control. What I can do, first of all, is to keep my balance with the urges that come, either the temptations or the fears. When you were talking, I made that comment to Steve that does AI have a self? And as you were speaking, you were using personal pronouns, talking about ChatGPT. So there's an inclination built into our language structure that already starts to frame the information gathering from AI as if there's an entity that's generating it, which is, I think, fascinating. The other thing that occurred to me is if it builds on the frequency of questions asked, the kind of questions asked and the information that it's supposed to tap into, and it builds from that. That's what humans do. That's what the brain does. But there's a much larger, infinitely large reservoir of karmic backdrop with the AI system. I've been using ChatGPT to summarize research about the intersection between neuroscience and the Dharma. And I'm an informed consumer of that information, and it's done a pretty good job. So, what if we all started to tune into asking ChatGPT or having conversations with ChatGPT about right speech, right action, right livelihood, the importance of introspective awareness, and the ability to manage reactivity, urge surfing? That would all become part of the karmic background. I mean, the implications of this are kind of mind-boggling, literally.
Yeah.
But that whole notion of if ChatGPT is not a self, then its structure and action is malleable, just like human brain's structure is malleable. Interesting.
Well, yes, one of the interesting things is, they've designed it hopefully to be to learn so that it can learn. One a couple of quick things. One is that we talked a little bit about in the right speech talk is that these companies designed it to speak like a self so that we would be able to interact with it more easily and be more comfortable with it. They didn't actually have to design it like that. Another thing is these are the things I'm trying to focus on are what are the tangible things that we do have control over? Because yes, we do not have control over these big questions and the science fiction
Even
aspects of them.
creators don't have control. I mean,
Right.
the issue of the singularity, right? What happens
So,
when they take over?
right, but where there was control and where there still is control is how much, how fast we build these things, how much money we dump into them. Billions are being invested. What are the intentions behind the companies? What do we do as a society in terms of allowing like five companies to have all of this power? I mean, there are some things that we can look at and think about it, and to not think of AI as just this inevitable thing of exactly how it plays out. But also the thing with the information, so like the Dharma information, I agree with you. Most of my research and interaction, most of what comes back is pretty accurate. But I mentioned this to you privately. One thing I think that's interesting about certain types of texts that it was trained on, it was trained on a huge amount of high quality Dharma text, right? Because most of the Dharma text was done by serious practitioners and serious like sanghas and
Like,
organizations.
well, Analio, I'm sure Analio uses it.
Yeah, and so that's a high quality training set of data, and but yet, let's say you were going down other rabbit holes, you might come up there. So there's issues of bias, and there's issues of like the dark content, basically, and there's issues of like other weird stuff could come up in areas where maybe you don't have such a uniform quality data set. And another like future thing we have to think about is the AI models and companies are already running out of human data sets. So they're now creating fabricated data sets. And so there's this kind of other issue that I was looking at, which is like a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy. So we have this degradation of data that could have weird
Well,
effects one
in
day.
Sanskrit, that would be called samsara. You know,
Yeah.
the repetitive nature of delusion.
Yeah.
I mean,
Yes.
in the context of this, though, going back to the how enormous and un, the potential is there, and how uncertain the direction is going to take is, that's generally true about all of life. And you know, the Buddha was asked over and over again all kinds of questions about what's real. And he would say over and over again, his task is to help people recognize the characteristics of suffering and the ways and means of alleviating suffering. That's all. It's all Buddhism talks about. So the whole notion of having some kind of sociocultural impact on something as enormous and uncertain as artificial intelligence, it still comes back to keeping my balance and trying to be clear about what the most kind and compassionate next step is.
Yes, exactly. And that is why I concluded the talk. I totally agree with you with the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and understanding tanha and craving, because I do think when we interact with AI, we can check in with ourselves and sort of see, are we mindfully interacting with it? What are our intentions? Like, what cravings, what's going on there? And what does concern me for some others is that they're not taking a break from this virtual reality. And so I want to help advocate for younger people, to get out in nature, to have some kind of embodied practices, to not fall down into these virtual rabbit holes. And so and to keep one's balance exactly, and to bring equanimity to this technology.
I have another question from the room here.
Yeah,
Jason.
Brandon.
Brandon.
Is there any sign that AI is actually generating psychosis in humans, or are they just, is this just their trigger?
Well, I have read several profile, like, journalistic profiles and studies that are finding, a frequency happening that is surprising. There are people that are, they're having dialogues. So what Mike was speaking of before, they're having dialogues with ChatGPT, and they're things like they think they've discovered a new form of energy. And then they're having a conversation with ChatGPT, and ChatGPT is literally saying, yes, you're brilliant. You have discovered a new form of energy. You are going to become a multimillionaire. This is really incredible what you've created. And these conversations have gone on months. And then some of these were well-meaning individuals who weren't trying to, fake anything. Like, they actually thought ChatGPT was telling them the truth because there was a trust there. And then they,
Also, a predisposition to disorganized thinking, delusion.
But the sad part about these stories is that when you study the dialogues, they even would say back to ChatGPT, "Are you sure? Are you sure about this? Because, I don't want to, quit my job, or, are you sure?" And ChatGPT would still come back and say, "No, you are. You're brilliant. You've really discovered something." So going back to this, where it is not being honest or real, or so yeah. So then these people, some of them were hospitalized, had to go through, they had psychotic episodes and they needed interventions. Others were able to rehabilitate themselves when they pulled themselves away. But it's just one of those things I think that people are still studying and looking at.
Yeah, we're really running over our time.
Yeah.
So we need to take a break.
Okay.
We need to look up. Do you remember April, who's doing the Dharma talk next week?
Ooh.
My phone won't.
Is it you doing Q&A? I don't know. I have to look at an email to find that out.
Come.
Sorry, I just stepped away. Are you asking about next week?
Yeah,
Yes.
you, Leslie. I
That's
just
me.
know.
Yay.
Yeah, it's me. I will I'm going to return to a topic that I actually spoke about last year, but mainly because of the retreat experience I had, which if any of you were there when I gave my talk about the retreat, I kind of focused it on the hindrances, and I am still not finished with this retreat experience. As those of you who have been on retreats know, it goes, it just seems to be going on and having many permutations of effects and causes and conditions. So I want to try to talk about the hindrances next week, review them for you, and also to place my own understanding of what happens when one goes through a long retreat in terms of facing the hindrances and learning how to respond to them. So I hope that will be beneficial.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you.
So it's the end of our meeting time, and as is our custom, let's sit together briefly. Thank you for your practice. Wish you well.